Chapter 17. Under the cover of pre-dawn darkness, the submersible Sea Dog 2, with Pitt and Giordino inside, was lifted from her crate by the loading crane, swung over the side of the ship, and slowly lowered into the water. A crewman standing on top of the submersible unhooked the cable and was hauled back on board. Then the Oregon shore launch pulled alongside and attached a tow line. Giordino stood in the open hatch that was raised 3 feet above the water, while Pitt continued ticking off the instrument and equipment checklist. "Ready when you are," announced Max Hanley from the launch. "We'll descend to 10 feet," said Giordino. "When we reach that level, you can get underway."
"Understood."
Giordino closed the hatch and stretched out beside Pitt in the submersible, which had the appearance of a fat Siamese cigar with stubby wings on each side that curved to vertical on the tips. The 20-foot-long, 8-foot-wide, 3,200-pound vehicle may have looked ungainly on the surface, but underwater she dived and turned with the grace of a baby whale. She was propelled with 3 thrusters in the twin tail section that impelled water through the front intake and expelled it out the rear. With a light touch on the 2 hand grips, one controlling pitch and dive, the other banks and turns, along with the speed control lever, the Sea Dog 2 could glide smoothly a few feet under the surface of the sea, or dive to a depth of 2,000 feet in a matter of minutes. The pilots, who lay prone with their heads and shoulders extending into a single transparent glass bow, had a much wider range of visibility than provided by most submersibles with only small viewing ports. Visibility beneath the surface was nil. The water enclosed the sub like a thick quilt. Looking up and ahead, they could just barely make out the shadowy outline of the launch. Then came a deep rumble as Cabrillo increased the RPMs of the powerful Rodec 539 cubic inch 1,500-horsepower engine that drove the big double-ender launch. The propeller thrashed the water, the stern dug in, and the launch strained before surging forward with the bulky submersible in tow. Like a diesel locomotive pulling a long train up a grade, the launch struggled to gain momentum, finally increasing its speed until it was dragging the dead weight below the water at a respectable 8 knots. Unknown to Pitt and Giordino, Cabrillo had the throttle of the powerful engine set at only 1/3 power. During the short journey from the Oregon to the United States, Pitt programmed the onboard computer analyzer that automatically set and monitored the oxygen level, electronics, and the depth control systems. Giordino activated the manipulator arm by running it through a series of exercises.
"Is the communications antenna up?" Pitt asked him.
Lying next to him, Giordino nodded slightly.
"I let out the cable to a maximum length of 60 feet as soon as we entered the water. She's dragging on the surface behind us." "How did you disguise it?"
Giordino shrugged. "Another cunning ploy of the great Albert Giordino. I encased it in a hollowed-out cantaloupe."
"Stolen from the chef, no doubt."
Giordino gave Pitt a hurt look.
"Waste not, want not.
It was overripe, and she was going to throw it in her garbage collector."
Pitt spoke into a tiny microphone. "Chairman Cabrillo, do you read me?"
"Like you were sitting next to me, Mr. Pitt."
Cabrillo came back quickly.
Like the other 5 men in the launch, he was dressed as a local fisherman.
"As soon as we reach our drop zone, I'll release the communications relay antenna so we can remain in contact after you've returned to the Oregon. When I drop the antenna, its weighted line will settle into the silt and it will act as a buoy."
"What is your range?"
"Underwater, we can transmit and receive up to 1,500 yards.
"Understood," said Cabrillo.
"Stand by, we're only a short distance away from the liner's stern. I won't be able to come in much closer than 50 yards.
"Any sign of a security force?" The whole ship and dock look as dead as a crypt in winter. Standing by. Cabrillo was better than his word. He slowed the launch until it barely maintained headway and steered it almost directly under the stern of the United States. The sun was coming up as a diver slipped over the side and descended down the tow line to the submersible. "Diver is down," Cabrillo announced. "We see him," answered Pitt, looking up through the transparent nose. He watched as the diver released the connection mechanism mounted on top of the submersible between the twin tubes and gave the familiar OK sign with one hand before disappearing up the tow line. "We are free." "Make a turn 40 degrees to your starboard," directed Cabrillo. "You are only 80 feet west of the stern." Giardino gestured up through the murky depth at the immense shadow that gave the illusion it was passing over them. The seemingly unending shape was enhanced by the sunlight filtering between the dock and the gigantic hull. "We have her." "You're on your own. Rendezvous will be at 4:30. I'll have a diver waiting at your antenna mooring." "Thank you, Juan," said Pitt, feeling free to use the chairman's first name. "We couldn't have done it without you and your exceptional crew." "I wouldn't have it any other way," Cabrillo came back cheerfully. Giardino gazed in awe at the monstrous rudder looming overhead and pressed the lever that dropped the antenna's anchor into the silt on the bottom. From their position, the hull seemed to travel off into infinity. "She appears to be riding high. Do you recall her draft?" "I'd have to make a wild guess," said Pitt. "Somewhere around 40 feet, give or take." "Judging from the look of her, your guess is a good 5 feet on the low side." Pitt made Cabrillo's course correction and dipped the Sea Dog 2's bows into deeper water. "I'd better be careful or we'll bump our heads." Pitt and Giardino had worked as a team on countless dives into the abyss and operated a score of submersibles on various NUMA projects. Without any discussion, each man spontaneously assumed his well-practiced responsibilities. Pitt acted as pilot, while Giardino kept an eye on the systems monitor, operated the video camera, and worked the manipulator arm. Pitt gently eased the throttle lever forward, directing the sub's movement by angling and tilting the three thrusters with the hand grip controls, dodging beneath the giant rudder, and banking around the two starboard screws. Like some nocturnal flying machine, the submersible slipped around the three bladed bronze propellers that spanned the watery gloom like great, beautifully curved fans. The Sea Dog 2 continued silently through the water, which became an eerie, opaque green. The bottom appeared as distant land through a fog. Assorted trash dumped off ships and the dock over the years lay partially embedded in the silt. They soared over a rusting deck grate that was home to a small school of squid that drifted in and out of the parallel rows of square openings. Pitt guessed that it had simply been dumped by dockyard workers sometime in the past. He stopped the thrusters and settled the craft into the soft bottom beneath the liner's stern. A small cloud of silt filtered up and outward like a brown vapor, momentarily obscuring any view through the forward canopy. Overhead, the hull of the United States stretched above them into the dusky water like a dark, ominous shroud. There was a sense of loneliness on the desolate bottom. The real world above did not exist. "I think it best if we took a few minutes and thought this thing out," said Pitt. "Don't ask me why," said Giardino, "but a dumb joke from my childhood suddenly popped into my head." "What joke is that?" "The goldfish that blushed when it saw the Queen Mary's bottom." Pitt made a sour face. "The simple things that come from simple minds. You should rot in purgatory for resurrecting that old turkey." Giardino acted as if he didn't hear. Not to change the titillating subject, but I wonder if these clowns thought of using eavesdropping sensors around the hull. Unless we bump into one dangling from the dock, we have no way of telling. Still pretty dark to make out any detail. I'm thinking we can set our light beams on the low end and begin inspecting the keel. Our chances of being spotted that deep beneath the hull are unlikely. Then, as the sun rises higher in the sky, we can work out and up toward the waterline. Pitt nodded. Hardly a brilliant plan, but it's the best I can come up with under the circumstances. Then we'd better get a move on, said Giordino, if we don't want to suck our oxygen dry. Pitt engaged the thrusters, and the submersible slowly rose from the silt until it was only 4 feet below the keel. He concentrated on keeping the Sea Dog 2 on an even plane, glancing every few seconds at his positioning monitor to guide him on a straight track while Giordino peered upward, his eyes searching for any irregularity that indicated an exit or entry hatch that had been riveted in the bottom of the hull, taping any suspicious piece or workmanship with the video camera. After a few minutes, Pitt found it more expedient to ignore the monitor and simply follow the horizontal seams between the hull plates through the transparent canopy. On the surface, the sun's rays pierced the depths, increasing visibility. Pitt switched off the exterior lights. The steel plates, black in the earlier darkness, now became a dull red as the anti-fouling paint became more evident. There was a slight current caused by the outgoing tide, but Pitt held the submersible steady as the inspection continued. For the next 2 hours, they glided back and forth as if mowing a lawn, each man strangely silent, intent on his job. Suddenly, Cabrillo's voice broke the silence. "Care to make a progress report, gentlemen?" "No progress to report," Pitt answered. "One more sweep and we'll have finished the bottom of the hull. Then it's up the sides toward the waterline." "Let's hope your new paint job makes it tough to spot you from the surface." "Max Hanley and his crew laid on a darker green tint than I'd planned," said Pitt. "But if nobody stares down in the water, we should be okay." "The ship still looks deserted." "I'm glad to hear it." "See you in 2 hours and 18 minutes, said Cabrillo jovially. "Try not to be late." "We'll be there," Pitt promised. "Al and I don't want to hang around down here any longer than we have to." "Standing by and out." Pitt leaned his head toward Giordino without looking at him. "How's our oxygen supply?" he asked. "Tolerable," Giordino replied briefly. "Battery power still reads steady, but it's creeping slowly toward the red line." They finished the final run working out from the keel. Pitt guided the little craft along the section of the hull that curved upward toward the waterline. The next hour passed with agonizing slowness, and nothing out of the ordinary was revealed. The tide turned and began flowing in from the sea, bringing cleaner water and increasing visibility to nearly 30 feet. Swinging around the bow, they began working the starboard side, which was moored next to the dock, not rising to within 10 feet of the surface. "Time remaining?" Pitt asked tersely, without lifting a hand to glance at his doxodive watch. 57 minutes to rendezvous with the Oregon's launch," replied Giordino.
"This trip definitely wasn't worth the effort. If Chin Chang is sneaking aliens on and off the United States, it isn't by means of an underwater passage or submarine-type vessel." "Doesn't figure he'd do it topside in the open," said Giordino. "Not in enough numbers to make it pay. Immigration agents would tag the operation 10 minutes after the boat hit port." "Nothing more we can do here. Let's wrap up and head home." "That may present a problem." Pitt glanced sideways at Giordino. "How so?" Giordino nodded through the canopy. "We have visitors." Ahead of the submersible, 3 divers materialized out of the green void, swimming toward them like evil demons in their black wetsuits. "What do you think the fine is for trespassing in these parts? I don't know, but I'll bet it's more than a slap on the wrist. Giordino studied the divers who were approaching, one in the center, the other two circling from the flank. Most odd they didn't spot us earlier, long before we made our last run just under the waterline. Somebody must have looked over the side and reported a funny green monster, Pitt said facetiously. I'm serious. It's almost as if they sat back observing us until the last minute. Do they look mad? They ain't bringing flowers and candy. Weapons? Looks like Mosby underwater rifles. The Mosby was a nasty weapon that fired a missile with a small explosive head through water. Though devastating against human body tissue, Pitt didn't believe it could cause serious damage to a submersible able to withstand the pressures of the deep. The worst we can expect is scratched paint and a few dents. Don't get cocky just yet, said Giordino, staring at the approaching divers as a doctor might study an X-ray. These guys are making a coordinated assault. Their helmets must contain miniature radios. Our pressure hull may take a few good knocks, but one lucky shot into the impellers of our thrusters and we'll end up desecrated. We can outrun them, said Pitt confidently. He banked the Sea Dog 2 in a tight turn, set the thrusters on high, and steered for the stern of the liner. This boat can travel a good 6 knots faster than any diver encumbered with air tanks. Life isn't fair, Giordino muttered, more annoyed than fearful, as they unexpectedly found themselves confronting another 7 divers hovering in a semicircle beneath the ship's mammoth propellers, blocking off their avenue of escape. It seems the goddess of serendipity has turned her back on us. Pitt switched on his microphone and hailed Cabrillo over the radio. This is Sea Dog 2. We have a total of 10 villains in hot pursuit. I read you, Sea Dog, and we'll take appropriate steps. No need to contact me further. Out. Not good, said Pitt grimly. We might dodge past 2 or 3, but the rest can get close enough to do us real damage. Then a notion struck him. Unless what? Pitt didn't answer. Orchestrating the hand grip controls, he threw the Sea Dog 2 into a dive, then leveling out less than a foot off the bottom, and began a search pattern. Within 10 short seconds, he found what he was looking for. The deck grate he'd seen earlier loomed up out of the silt. Can you lift that thing out of the muck with the manipulator arm? He asked Giordino. The arm can handle the weight, but the suction is an unknown. It depends on how deep the grate is buried. Try. Giordino nodded silently and quickly slipped his hands over the ball-shaped controls to the mechanical arm and tightened his fingers. Exercising a delicate touch, he rotated the balls in a manner similar to moving the mouse on a computer. He extended the arm, which was articulated at the elbow and wrist like human joints. Next, he placed the mechanical hand grip over the top of the grate and tightened the 3 hinged fingers. One grate in hand, he announced. Give me all the vertical thrust in the cupboard. Pitt tilted the thrusters upward and poured on every ounce of their remaining battery power as the divers from Chin Chang's security force closed to within 20 feet. For a tormenting few seconds, nothing happened. Then the grate slowly began to slip from the silt, stirring up a great cloud of silt as the sub pulled it free. Twist the arm until the grate is in a horizontal position, ordered Pitt. Then hold it over the front of the thruster intakes. They can still shoot an explosive up our tail. Only if they carry muck-penetrating radar, said Pitt, reversing the thrusters and tilting them down so their exhaust blasted into the bottom, raising great billows of swirling silt. Now you see us, now you don't. Giordino grinned approvingly. An armored shield? A self-induced smoke screen? What more could we ask? Now let's get the hell out of here. Pitt needed no coaching. He sent the submersible careening across the bottom, stirring up silt as he went. Traveling every bit as visually blind as the divers, through the agitated sediment, but not nearly as confused, He had the advantage of an acoustic system that homed him in on the antenna buoy. He had traveled only a short distance when the submersible experienced a hard thump. "They hit us?" Pitt asked. Giordino shook his head. "No, I think you can scratch one of our attackers off as a roadkill. You almost tore his head off with the starboard wing." "He won't be the only casualty if they blindly miss and shoot each other." Pitt was cut off as an explosive thud rocked the Sea Dog 2. Two more followed in quick succession. The submersible's speed fell off by a third. "There's that lucky shot I was talking about," said Giordino matter-of-factly. "They must have slipped one under the grate." Pitt glanced at his instruments. "They caught the port thruster." Giordino placed a hand on the transparent nose, which had a series of tiny cracks and stars on its outer surface. "They pitted the hell out of the windshield, too." "Where did the third missile strike?" "Impossible to see through this stuff, but I suspect the vertical stabilizer on the starboard wing is gone."
"I figured as much," said Pitt. "She's pulling to the port."
Unknown to them, the team of 10 divers was down to 6. Besides the one Pitt crashed into, the others, shooting indiscriminately through the brownout, had struck and killed 3 of their own number. Firing and reloading their Mosby underwater rifles as fast as they could insert a new explosive charge, the divers overlooked the danger to themselves. One was brushed by the submersible as it surged past, and he fired point blank. "Another hit," reported Giordino. He twisted his body in the confined space and gazed back along the submersible's starboard hull. "This time they caught the battery case." "Those Mosby explosive heads must be more powerful than I was led to believe." Giordino jerked his eyes back and to the side as another explosion burst on the frame between the starboard hull and the nose-viewing shield. Water began to spurt in where metal met glass. "Those things do more than scratch paint and make dents," said Giordino. "I can vouch for it." "We're losing power to the thrusters," came Pitt's voice in a precision display of unruffled coolness. "That last strike must have caused a short in the system. Dump the grate. It's causing too much drag." Giordino complied, working the manipulator controls and releasing the grate. Through the silt cloud, he could see several places in the grate where the rusting iron had been gouged away by the explosive charges. He watched it fall out of sight back into the sediment on the bottom. "So long, old pal. You served your purpose." Pitt stared briefly at a small navigation monitor. 200 feet to the antenna. "My Macus about to pass under the liner's screws." "No hits in the last minute," said Giordino. "We must have left our angry friends behind in the fog. I suggest you cut back on your throttles and conserve whatever battery power is left." "Nothing left to conserve," replied Pitt, pointing to the instrument dial indicating battery power. "We're down to 1 knot and the needle is in the red." Giordino smiled tightly. "It would make my day if Shang's divers got lost and gave up the chase." "We'll know soon," said Pitt. "I'm going to angle up and out of the cloud. The instant we break into clear water, look astern and tell me what you see." "If they're still hanging around," said Giordino, "and they spot us limping along at 1/2 knot, they'll be all over us like maddened wasps." Pitt said nothing as the Sea Dog 2 emerged from the swirling mudstorm. He squinted his eyes, trying to pierce the velvet green water, searching for the antenna line and Cabrillo's diver. A vague silhouette, wavering 70 to 80 feet ahead and slightly to port, slowly evolved into the bottom of the launch, rocking in the waves rolling across the harbor. "We're almost home," Pitt exclaimed. His spirits lifted. "Stubborn little devils," said Giordino morosely. 5 of them are swimming like sharks up our tail." "Smart fellas to catch on so quick. They must have kept one man in the clear as a lookout. Soon as he caught us rising out of the gunk, he alerted his pals by radio." An explosive charge smashed against one of the Sea Dog 2's tail stabilizers and blew it away. A second charge narrowly missed the hemispherical nose section.
Pitt fought for control, urging, willing the submersible on a straight course toward the launch. The instant he saw one of Shang's divers out of the corner of his eyes, overtaking and coming in from the flank of the sub, he knew it was all but over. Without battery power and help from Cabrillo, there was no escape. "So near, yet so far," Giardino mumbled, staring upward at the keel of the launch as he waited helpless but unperturbed for the inevitable final assault. Then suddenly a series of concussions swamped and reverberated all around the submersible. Pitt and Giardino were thrown about the interior like rats inside a rolling pipe. The water around them erupted in a mass of froth and bubbles that raged crazily in all directions before heading for the surface. The divers, who were about to close in on the Sea Dog 2, died instantly, their bodies crushed to gelatin by the sledgehammer blows. The men inside the sub were both stunned and deafened by underwater detonations. They were saved from serious injury by the pressure hull. It took several moments for Pitt to realize that Cabrillo, forewarned of the chase in progress, waited until the submersible and its attackers were close enough to the Oregon's launch to throw concussion grenades into the water. Through the ringing in his ears, Pitt heard someone calling over the radio. "You guys all right down there?" came Cabrillo's welcome voice. "My kidneys will never be the same," Pitt answered back, "but we're behaving ourselves." "How about the vigilantes?" "They look like they came out of a jello mold," replied Giardino. "If we were attacked underwater," Pitt warned Cabrillo, "it stands to reason they'll come after you on the surface." "Funny you should mention that," said Cabrillo airily. "There just happens to be a small cruiser coming this way as we speak. Nothing we can't handle, of course. Sit tight. I'll have my diver hook you up to the tow line after we greet our callers." "Sit tight," Giardino repeated acidly. "We have no power. We're dead in the water. He must think we're in an underwater amusement park." "He means well," Pitt sighed, as the tension inside the sub eased. He lay there idly, his hands loosely holding the hand grips of his now non-functioning controls, staring through the transparent canopy at the bottom of the launch, wondering what cards Cabrillo was about to deal. "They mean business," Cabrillo said to Eddie Sung, the Oregon's former CIA agent, who was their man in Beijing for nearly 20 years, before he was forced to make a sudden departure back to the States and retirement. Cabrillo peered through a small single-lens telescope at the rapidly approaching cabin cruiser. Its configuration reminded him of a U.S. Coast Guard rescue boat, except that this one was not in the business of saving lives. "They figured the game when they detected the submersible, but they can't be sure we're tied in until they board and investigate." "How many do you make out?" asked Sung. "About 5, all carrying arms except the helmsman." "Any good-sized weapons mounted on the boat?" asked Sung. "None that I can make out. They're on a fishing expedition and not looking for trouble. They'll leave 2 men behind to cover us, while the other 3 come on board." Cabrillo turned to Sung. "Tell Pete James and Bob Meadows to slip over the unobserved side of the launch. They're both strong swimmers. When the boat comes alongside, tell them to swim under our craft and hang in the water between the hulls. If my plan works, the 2 guards remaining behind on their boat will instinctively react to an unexpected situation. We've got to take all 5 without guns. Nothing that makes noise. There'll be enough prying eyes on the dock and ship as it is. We'll just have to tough it out the best we can without drums and bugles." James and Meadows slipped over the side under a tarpaulin and waited in the water for the signal to swim under the launch. The rest of Cabrillo's men lounged around the decks as if dozing. 1 or 2 acted as if they were fishing off the stern. Now Cabrillo could plainly see that Chin Shang Maritime's security men were wearing showy, dark maroon uniforms that were better suited for a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta. 4 of them clutched what looked to Cabrillo like the latest model machine pistols manufactured by the Chinese. The boat's captain wore the indecipherable, hard expression of a Chinese in authority. "Remain where you are," he shouted in Mandarin. "We are coming aboard." "What do you want?" Sung yelled back. "Dockyard security. We want to inspect your boat." "You're not the harbor patrol," said Sung indignantly. "You have no authority over us." "You have 30 seconds to comply or we shoot," the captain said with icy persistence. "You'd shoot, poor fisherman," Sung said bitterly. "You're mad." He turned to the others and shrugged. "We'd better do as they say. They're just crazy enough to do what they threaten." "All right," he said to the Chin Shang Maritime Security Captain. "Come aboard. But don't think I'm not going to report you to the People's Republic Harbor authorities." Cabrillo leaned over the helm, shielding his face with a straw hat so the security guards couldn't see his western eyes. He casually flipped a few coins over the side as the signal for James and Meadows to swim under the launch. Slowly, one of his hands snaked onto the throttle lever. Then, just as the captain of the security boat and his men were in the midst of leaping across the narrow gap separating the two craft, Cabrillo cracked the throttle open and, just as quickly, pulled it back, abruptly widening the gap between the two boats. As if the action was a rehearsed comedy routine, the security cruiser captain and his two men fell into the water between the two boats. Acting on impulse, as Cabrillo predicted, the two men still on the security boat dropped their weapons and fell to their knees, reaching out to their superior in an attempt to haul him out of the water. Their rescue attempt failed as two pairs of arms reached up out of the water, grabbed them each by the throat, and pulled them overboard with a wild splash. Then, taking one man at a time by the feet, James and Meadows hauled them under the launch to the opposite side, where they were rendered unconscious by a none too gentle rap on the back of the head before being pushed aboard and roughly dumped in a small cargo hold. Cabrillo scanned the stern of the United States and the end of the dock for witnesses. He counted no more than 3 or 4 shipyard workers who had paused to watch the activity on the two boats. None appeared unduly concerned. The cabin on the security cruiser had blocked off most of the view the workers had from the dock and the liner. As far as they could see, it looked like a normal investigation by the security force. All they could see was Cabrillo's crew still dozing and fishing off the stern of the launch. The shipyard workers soon returned to their jobs, showing no signs of alarm. James and Meadows climbed back on board, and, along with Eddie Sung, quickly stripped the security commander and two of his men of their clothes. A few minutes later, all three reappeared on deck wearing the security guard's uniforms. "Not a bad fit," said Eddie, modeling his damp attire for Cabrillo, "considering that the suit is soaking wet." "Mine is about 4 sizes too small," grumbled Meadows, who was a big man. "Join the club," said James, holding out an arm and demonstrating a sleeve that barely passed the elbow. "You don't have to walk down the runway at a fashion show," said Cabrillo, while jockeying the launch next to the security boat. "Jump over and take the helm. As soon as we've got the submersible under tow, follow along in our wake as though you were escorting us to the Hong Kong Harbor Patrol dock. Once we're out of sight of Chin Shang's shipyard, we'll cruise around until dark. Then we'll head back to the Oregon and scuttle the security boat." "What about the 5 drenched rats in the hold?" asked Sung. Cabrillo turned from the helm and leered. "We'll enjoy seeing the expressions on their faces when they wake up and find they've been abandoned on an island off the Philippines." Not having enough oxygen supply to remain underwater, the Sea Dog 2 was towed on the surface with the upper hatch partially open. Pitt and Giordino remained inside while the security boat cruised alongside and screened any view of it from passing ships and shore. 30 minutes later, the Sea Dog 2 was quickly lifted back onto the deck of the Oregon. Cabrillo was there to help Pitt and Giordino out of the submersible. With muscles stiff and numb from the many hours of tight confinement, they were grateful for his help. I apologize for leaving you cooped up like that, but as you know, we ran into a little difficulty. And you handled it very well, Pitt complimented him. You boys did a pretty fair job of fighting off the bad guys yourselves. We'd still be sitting on the bottom if you hadn't lobbed those grenades. What did you find? Asked Cabrillo. Pitt shook his head wearily. Nothing, absolutely nothing. The hull below the waterline is clean, no modifications, no concealed hatches or pressurized doors. The bottom has been scraped and recoated with anti-fouling paint and looks as unaltered as the day she was launched. If Chin Chang has a shifty method of slipping illegal aliens ashore in a foreign port, it's not from below the waterline. So, where does that leave us? Pitt gave Cabrillo a steady look. We've got to get inside the ship. Can you manage it? As the resident whiz, yes, I believe I can arrange a guided tour of the ship's interior. But consider this. 1, maybe 2 hours from now is all we have before the security guards we kidnapped are discovered as missing. The chief of Chin Chang Shipyard Security will put 2 and 2 together and figure the intruders came from the Oregon. No doubt he's already wondering how and why 10 of his divers went missing. Once he alerts the Chinese Navy, they'll come after us as sure as women bear babies. With a head start, the Oregon can outdistance most any ship in the Chinese fleet. If they send planes after us before we can get out of their territorial waters, we're dead. You're well armed, said Giordino. Cabrillo tightened his lips. But not immune to warships with heavy guns and aircraft with missiles. The sooner we get the hell out of Hong Kong and onto the high seas, the safer we'll be. Then you're pulling up anchor and skipping town, said Pitt. I didn't say that. Cabrillo looked over at Sung, who had thankfully changed into dry clothes. What say you, Eddie? Do you want to put the uniform of a Chin Chang security chief back on and parade around the shipyard like a big man on campus? Sung grinned. I've always wanted to tour the inside of a big cruise ship without paying for a ticket. Then it's settled, said Cabrillo directly to Pitt. Go now. See what you have to see and get back here fast, or we'll all regret not knowing our grandchildren.